On this episode of Skeptico, blogger and creator of the popular paranormal website, The Daily Grail, Greg Taylor.
We just need to keep on plugging along and just keep educating the public, and just keep following the data wherever it leads, as you said. That's the most important thing, is just that science, following the data wherever it leads. People can call you anti-science, or as Randy has called me, a grubby, but if you follow the data, then you're doing science, and we should not worry too much about what other people call us.
Stay with us for Skeptico.
Welcome to Skeptico, where we explore controversial science with leading researchers, thinkers, and their critics. I'm your host, Alex Sakaris, and on this episode of Skeptico, I have a very interesting interview with Greg Taylor, the founder and main blogger over at the Daily Grail, a paranormal website that I think many of you are familiar with or maybe should be familiar with. Very, very interesting website. Does a great job of kind of balanced reporting on strange, anomalous stuff and also some skeptical stuff with a real intelligent edge to it. I've always enjoyed it, and I really enjoyed the chance to get to know Greg a little bit and speak with him on this interview where we talked a lot about skepticism and what it's like kind of trying to be a counterweight to that skeptical voice that is out there in so many places. Very interesting chat. I think you'll enjoy it. Coming up, my dialogue with Greg Taylor of the Daily Grail. Basically, I want to kind of keep it pretty casual and just kind of have a chat. We're obviously both interested in a lot of the same topics and are covering it. And what I thought a lot of folks would like to know, because I've tried in the past to kind of dig up information on who is the Daily Grail and what's it all about. And I don't know if it's just me, but I haven't been able to find a lot of that information. So tell me the story, the Daily Grail.
It sort of came about around 1998. There were lots of websites, as you know, even less than now, but still, it took a lot of my time to go through each day and visit all these different websites I was interested in, because I'm interested in lots of various topics. And it just came to me that it would be nice to have a central resource where people could see the latest news on all these things. So that was basically the birth of the Daily Grail. And for a start, it was, it was back in the old days of just updating the page by hand, FTPing it up every day. It was very work intensive. But the hits went from 10 people a day to 100 people a day to 1,000 people a day, and now we're up around 15,000 people a day. So it obviously serves a purpose, and I'm glad so many people enjoy it.
And go ahead and give us the 30-second summary of what y'all cover and what you're particularly interested in at any given time.
30 seconds. That could be tough. I guess the quick explanation would be anything outside the paradigm. I like knowledge right on the edge, so that's what excites me. Generally, skeptics mean it means think that it means you're a woo-woo or a strange person, but I like it. So it's UFOs, it's afterlife, it's parapsychology, it's little bits of history that you don't know about that might change the way you view history or even view the present. It's all those sorts of things. Most people sort of call those 14 subjects, so that's probably the best description. I think where I'd still have a little problems with the Daily Grail is that, one, I'm interested in all these topics, and I just love reading this strange stuff, and even if it's a little bit fringish, I still really enjoy reading it, and I just read it with a bit of humor to it. I don't take it too seriously, which, again, skeptics, I think, don't seem to grasp that you can look at these things and not be falling off the edge of the earth. But on the other hand, I also like the really hard evidence that's coming out, some of the stuff you're doing with the afterlife research, parapsychology research, some of the really good UFO cases, some of the evidence in there. And so I think sometimes that it's hard to mesh both of them on the Daily Grail, because sometimes people want to see it as a place where you go to get the really hard evidence about a lot of these fringe topics. And other times I just like to, put some strange stuff up there, which, to a skeptic would devalue it as, being respectable. So, but anyway, that's what I like. I like the 14 stuff, and I also like exploring things scientifically as well.
Well, you know, I think that's really, really an interesting point, because as you get to the fringe, and I kind of hate that term, but as you get to the fringe of science or the fringe of these anomalies or even UFO stuff, which I don't talk much about, but I have to say over the last year or so, I find more and more of that data out there, and I just don't know what to do with it because it kind of butts up against what I thought I knew, and yet some of it is just very, very hard to dismiss, but that's kind of a whole other tangent. But I think your point is really, really interesting, because I think when you delve into it and then you realize that, hey, I'm really not that far from taking that other step to something else that is way past what I believe in, or I already know is pure fantasy, and it really starts blending together in a way that does kind of challenge us, doesn't it, to kind of know where to draw that line between that very tenuous thing that we call reality.
It is, yeah. And that's the value of real skepticism, I think, that you just keep every day, you check yourself, you say, you know, do I have evidence here? Or if I don't have evidence, is it worthy of further investigation? And things like that, you know. Things like what might be called entity visitation, like people getting visited by aliens or fairies or leprechauns, whatever you want to have it. You know, is that, you know, if I bring that up in conversation to someone that's not familiar with it, it's, you know, it's crazy stuff. It's, you are loopy, full on loopy, and I recognize that fully. But then if you get down, and one of my little research areas is all these commonalities that happen in these experiences. I wrote a essay in our anthology Dark Lore a little while back about how all these various things, alien abductions, fairy sightings, and all that sort of stuff, they have commonalities that are there. You know, there's this buzzing sound or musical sound that's at the beginning of it. And then sometimes, you know, quite often there's a fog and it turns into this, you know, into the entity and stuff like that. There's commonalities when there shouldn't be across all these experiences. And so even though I don't view it as a reality, there is something going on here. You know, it's not people just making stuff up. There's something going on and it's worthy of further investigation. So, you know, that's one of the things for me, is to just keep looking for these, I think Margaret Mead called it recurrent regularities that you find in these anomalies. And it's the same for the afterlife research too. You know, you just get these recurrent regularities that just make you go, there's something more here that needs investigation and it shouldn't be ignored by science.
Well, yeah, and I, one step further, I mean, I think that natural history is really the basis and has been the basis all along for good science. It all starts with observation, and when we start observing those patterns, then we have to dig deeper. The problem has been, as I talk about on this show, and I think as you've explored in the Daily Grail, is when we hit these boundaries that become the taboo that you're not supposed to cross over, but yet somebody has to cross over them, and I think that's partly what you're trying to do in melding these different areas together.
Yeah, and I think it should be partly taboo. You know, you're right on the fringe, and so there should be some caution about it, and there should be that taboo. I spoke to Deborah Blum about her book Ghost Hunters, and she sort of reinforced that, said that, you know, perhaps there should be that taboo, but, you know, it just stops people and just goes, hold on a second, I need to be very skeptical here. But on the other hand, you know, as you know well and I know, there are skeptics that go fully the other way, and as soon as you take a step there, it's more than taboo. You know, you just become an outcast, and that's just completely off limits. So, you know, that's taking it too far. It's about sort of finding, as you said, just finding that little space there where you're comfortable doing it, but it's not right off the chart.
It's funny that you say that, and it's funny when we talk about skeptics, because I talk about skeptics on my show a lot, and I think it comes up in the stuff that you produce as well. And I have to wonder, you know, I mean, what role do you see the skeptical community playing in this dialogue that's going on and this changing, evolving view that we have of consciousness and the paranormal? What do you see the role of the skeptical community? And do you see that role changing or being in a process of change over the last, I don't know, 4 or 5 years?
That's a good question. I think the whole modern skeptical movement as it is, I think, isn't going to contribute a lot, because it's just that mentality of crowds. You know, no one's going to be game to step forward and try and engage too much, I think. I think Stephen Novella, you know, what you're doing there, that's a step in the right direction. Stephen is probably one of the more open skeptics. He still has his moments, but he still has some, you know, really good moments of saying, let's look at the evidence here. But then, you know, you compare it to some of the others out there, Randy, people like that, who basically earn their living off it and seem to act that way, that, you know, they just have to act a certain way. But there's a changing of the guard, I think, you know, with Stephen Novella. Phil Plate, you know, is becoming very big. I have a few problems with Phil. I really enjoy his blog, and I think he's doing a great job educating people and things like that. But then he talks authoritatively about all these things, and then the subject of UFOs or the afterlife comes up, and he speaks the same way about them as if he knows, you know, says, you know, there's no such thing, blah, blah, blah. And it's quite obvious that he has not read the research at all. And so, you know, again, but I think there's room for movement with Phil Plate. You know, if you keep presenting evidence to him, he's going to move. Stephen Novella the same. If you can show some good evidence, he might move. So, you know, maybe there are some leaders in the movement that are going to progress things a little bit.
That's really interesting. And we just don't know. And it's a little bit of inside baseball here, but I think it's kind of a fascinating topic. I get the same impression from Steve Novella, and I think that's part of his popularity, is that there is this open-mindedness, or at least apparent open-mindedness. And the same, I think, you could say of DJ Grothy at Point of Inquiry, and I don't know, I've never talked to Platt. Isn't he the bad astronomer, isn't?
Yeah, the bad astronomer. Yeah.
I've heard him, and yeah, he's definitely knowledgeable and has a great little niche there. But you know what kind of makes me give a second thought to that, though, is, you know, the person I've probably had the most encounters with in that regard is Stephen Novella. And I have to say that, you know, the couple times where I feel like, you know, we've really gotten almost to the cusp of saying, okay, now can we say that, you know, Ray Hyman really did drop the ball with that critique of Dean Radin, you know, and you have to go through 3 hours of kind of tracking down every he said, she said, and then this is the paper and all that. There's no movement. At the end, there isn't that, you know, it's a Dick Cheney kind of, no, you know, I don't regret anything kind of thing.
Yeah, he sort of engages and then teases you right to the end and then just comes down. Yeah. Can't bridge that gap.
Yeah, and I wonder if it's any different. I wonder if Michael Shermer, who I find speaks very well and really has a good style and I enjoy hearing him speak, but I wonder the same way, you know, I mean, how can you explain away misinterpreting the Pin Van Lommel study of near-death experience, which he completely gets wrong, and then never retracts, never goes back, and never says, oh yeah, I did get that completely wrong, you know? So I don't know, are these guys really a new opening for the skeptical community, or is it just a rehashing and a polishing of the old guard that just is going to hold on tooth and nail to a paradigm that's, you know, slowly slipping away?
Yeah, I don't know. I do feel, you know, Plate, Novella, guys like that, they do seem like really good guys. So I hold out hope, but again, you know, the same thing.
Right.
You know, I've brought up a couple of problems with Phil Plate's things on UFOs, and, you know, he's just ignored them. You know, I've just pointed out, you are completely wrong here, but there's been nothing about it that, you know, he's called me a goofy anti-science guy for basically what was a positive review of his book. so you know, there's still that antipathy between skeptics and you know, us, I guess, people who are interested in the strange and paranormal. Although I don't think we should generalize either. You know, one of my pet hates is that, you know, guys like Phil go, those crazy ufologists, you know, when really he's talking about people who have no idea of UFOs, that just have this belief in UFOs and haven't really investigated. You know, real ufologists have some great things to say. So that generalization of just saying, you know, skeptics, oh, those skeptics, they're so close-minded. There are a lot of great skeptics out there, so we have to be careful in, you know, not doing the same as what we hate them doing to us.
Well, look, Greg, like who? Who is a great skeptic?
Oh, no, just, you know, if you go on message boards, there's some great guys that are very, you know, really tough on you, and you can really hone your skills against them in terms of debating them, but they will give. So, and I think, you know, there's lots of those guys out there, and just because you have these leaders who aren't, you know, going to move, then you shouldn't say that all skeptics are like that.
You know, I agree with that, of course. In general, I agree with that. But I have to tell you, you know, when I do a bunch of message board posting and at least lurking, and mainly posting on mine because it takes a while to get the podcast out and get the experiments, trying to get those off the ground. But I have to say, I'm pretty unimpressed in general with the skeptical collective mind there. You know, I find I don't know. I mean, you have to tell me where you go and where you find these hard-nosed skeptics that really do have a handle on the data and are able to kind of play both sides and see both sides. I have to say, I haven't seen it. I really haven't.
No, I think you're right on many counts. I don't like the generalizing, and there are some good skeptics out there. But again, you know, in terms of speaking about the future of skepticism, there's another point that I think it's growing. You know, the modern skeptical movement, as it is, for all its flaws, is growing quite a lot. And I think that's probably because the real appeal of skepticism is to the intellectual ego. You know, it's sort of,
right.
On one level, it says that we as humans know so much that, you know, we don't really need to know any more. Well, not that we don't need
right.
to, but we've pretty much got it all sorted.
Right.
And on a lower level, it gives that boost to the intellectual ego of saying, look at those crazy woo-woos. I'm glad I'm so much smarter than them. You know, so it has that attraction. And, you know, that really is attractive to geeks, you know, people online, all that sort of stuff. I call myself a geek, so I'm not trying to be, I'm not trying to put down the word geek. But it has that attraction to the geek sort of online population because, you know, that's their big thing, that they are intellectual and they are smart. And so skepticism has this great appeal to them. So I can only see skepticism really growing over the next few years, although probably for the wrong reason.
You know, you could be right, and I definitely think you're onto something in describing that intellectual kind of snobbery, but it almost seems to me, or sometimes has that feel to me, of someone who's read half the book, you know, or read the Cliff Notes and is out talking about their ideas, because I hear so many times these guys espousing critical thinking, and they'll kind of recite these logical fallacies over and over again. It's like, how about applying some of that critical thinking and some of that logic and looking at the data?
Yeah, I've had very long message board discussions where, you know, it's basically they're hitting their head up against a brick wall. You know, if you could take them outside the situation and say, are you applying critical thinking here? Yeah, I agree wholeheartedly. There are some real tough moments. But again, another thing is, you know, why are we so committed to, you know, engaging skeptics? Perhaps we should be just doing our research and just putting the results out there and just letting them speak for themselves, you know.
On one hand, I agree with you, but the subplot is that I think the biggest mistake that's been made is by not engaging with the skeptics enough. And one of the first things that really surprised me when I really stumbled into Skeptico and started talking with Dean Radin and Rupert Sheldrick and the likes, the people who are really top-notch researchers in parapsychology and psi phenomena, is that they had just were worn out. I mean, they had just been worn down by these skeptics. And I think, you know, the other part of the skeptical community, and we've been kind of really, as hard as we've been in this conversation here, we've really been kind of easy on the fact that there is this fringe in there that is really pretty nasty people that will kind of go yep. out of their way to really cause a lot of trouble for folks. And I think, I know because I've spoken to these researchers, I think a lot of these guys were totally caught off guard by just the kind of grief that a relatively few number of these people could cause. So I don't know how we get around that problem either, you know, the kind of evil side of the skeptical community, or what that skeptical drive to be superior and to kind of show off, you know, yields us.
I think, you know, I guess it's probably just about educating the public, and, you know, you've got a pretty good platform with Skeptico, and on Daily Growl I do the same. I posted an article a while back, The Myth of the $1 Million Challenge, which I think was a pretty rational look at, you know, just going through it, how the $1 million challenge means nothing, really. And, you know, it's always quoted by skeptics as, you know, disproving the existence of anything. But, you know, it means nothing. I did this rational thing. So, and that's had, I think, 30,000 reads now or so online. So, you know, it's a lot of people getting that information and maybe thinking about it a bit harder, even if Randy did call it a tirade. So, mm-hmm. Yeah, but I think it was a rational look at it, and I've probably educated a few people. So I think that's our goal, is to probably just keep spreading information. That's what the internet gives us, this chance to really educate people a bit more about the truth behind a lot of these claims.
Right. Oh, very well said, and I think that's great. You know, I haven't come across that article, so you've just motivated me to go read it, although I've certainly read enough about the the Randy challenge. I don't even want to talk about that. But there's the thing. I mean, that's what I think we wind up with. People like me saying, gee, I don't even want to talk about it. I'm worn out. And there's a lot of other people who are coming into the whole debate or the whole topic, and they're new to it. And the Randy challenge is foremost on their mind. So to that end, I don't think we can do enough to kind of hash it out over and over again. And I'm going to make a note here to point folks to that article that you posted.
If you just Google myth of the $1 million challenge, I think it's pretty much the top hit on Google. So
Great. And, you know, then your other point, I think, is definitely something that's near and dear to my heart. And, you know, about a year into Skeptico, what I really saw was that we do need to generate more research. And it's funny because, you know, when I talk to researchers, that one of the things I hear is we need to move beyond the kind of basic research, and we need to start exploring the subtleties of these phenomena and explore, for example, with afterlife, ask the kind of follow-on questions, because we can't just keep repeating the same experiment over and over again and show the kind of fundamental existence of the phenomena. We're past that. And boy, I think that's a mistake. I think that's just a big mistake. And I, again, coming at this thing just from the outside, I was like, hey, where's the disconnect here, guys? You guys can say we're past this and we already know that reincarnation is real or near-death experience suggests survival of consciousness, but we haven't converted very many. We certainly haven't converted very many mainstream academics. So don't we really need to go back and however many times we have to prove it again and again and again, then we need to do that until we get past that. And then we can start looking in the follow-on questions in terms of what form it takes or what's necessary to make it do this or do that. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I can understand the fatigue of researchers in that, though. You know, you look at the Piper case from 100 years ago, say, you know, to me, you look at the Piper case and you cannot walk away from that and go anything but, wow, there's something major going on here. You know, it proves that something is going on in the Piper case. There are thousands of pages of documentation, transcripts, everything. And so to come around 100 years later and say, we need to prove that something's going on here, sort of, it's very fatiguing to say, well, hasn't all this been done before in detail? But on the other hand, it is 100 years on, and it's a new generation. And, you know, the first thing, you bring the Piper case up to skeptics, they go, it was 100 years ago. Yeah, they weren't as smart as us back then, when, if you read the documentation, it's quite clear they were very skeptical. They knew all the tricks, all that sort of stuff. But
no, I agree. The Lenora Piper, all that stuff is really good. And you know, moreover, what I was just going to try and interject there is that when you read it, this stuff isn't hard. I mean, we're talking about science that doesn't require any kind of really advanced technology, right? I mean, they were just as capable of doing it 100 years ago as anyone would be today. I mean, there isn't any technological breakthrough. You don't need an fMRI. You don't need any of that stuff.
Yeah, the problem is that, you know, these days everyone wants, you know, results to a certain significance and things like that, whereas the Piper case is just transcripts, and it's just, you know, you read 1,000 pages and it's just time after time of anonymous sitter comes in, you know, Mrs. Piper knows nothing about them. There's no cold reading. You know, she just sits there. They don't talk. She sits there and just goes bang, bang, you know, name after name, name after name, detail after detail. And you see like 100 of those cases, and by the end you're going, well, it's pretty obvious that something's going on here. So there's no, but for a skeptic, can you say, you know, they showed that to, you know, odds of one in a million that, you know, she's doing? No, they didn't, because it wasn't that hard analytical study. So That's also a problem with, you know, trying to prove anything these days, is that you've got to come up with that significance.
Yeah, although I really don't think that's as hard as we sometimes. We've let the skeptics really kind of control that narrative. And part of the narrative is just that, oh, these experiments are very difficult to do and have to be controlled down to this level of precision or neither. And all that's bull. I mean, if you look at what's published in the social sciences, I mean, what we accept on a daily basis from getting published on, you know, the major newspapers or major magazines, the stuff that makes news and is real science, it doesn't have any of that degree of precision that that they're asking for there. So it's just another smokescreen. But, you know, that's an interplay. We're really kind of going on and on about the skeptical community. But that's good. It's probably a pretty good place to drive this dialogue. But In that vein, you know, the other thing I'd like to explore with you is the relationship between the skeptical community and the scientific community, because I think the skeptical community, what I've come to see, is really a great tool for providing cover for academics who are really glad to not look at this stuff.
Again, you have that, you know, the skepticism, the modern skepticism has just reached this point where they have such a high profile, you know, Sherman's in Scientific American and stuff like that, that they now have this ability, I think, to, you know, castigate scientists who do work on things like that. And that's something that really needs to be addressed by either, you know, fringe researchers or otherwise, that, you know, they have this platform. Randy, you know, he's a magician. He's a self-promoter. He regularly just deceives people when he talks. You know, he just basically makes things up. And yet he has this great scientific standing. You know, people listen to what he says. Somehow, I think the real battle, if you like, between fringe people and skeptics is trying to lessen the, you know, how much importance is given to skeptical writings. Because, you know, as you know, you go through Sherman stuff, you go through Randy stuff, Phil Plait stuff. I've gone through some of that myself. It's misinformed, it's wrong, sometimes it's just purely misleading, and it should not be held in any great esteem by the scientific community.
Yeah. Yeah, it's really disappointing. I mean, the lack of scholarship, to me, is stunning. I mean, because as you're pointing out, you know, there's two kinds of scholarship. One, there's the skeptical scholarship in terms of digging through their stuff and saying, gee, you know, this really doesn't hold water, or this Richard Wiseman study doesn't really prove anything. This is a debunking exercise. It shouldn't be passed off as science. So there's that level of scholarship of just being on top of the skeptical writings. But there's also just the lack of scholarship in terms of, you know, there are some folks that are plowing ahead and publishing interesting results on psi or afterlife or even UFOs. And when you talk to the folks who you really would expect to know this stuff, they don't. And that to me is really surprising.
Yeah, well, there was that example a couple of years ago of Rupert Sheldrake in the UK at that conference. But, you know, basically a guy standing there berating him, saying that Psy shouldn't be at this science conference, you know, blah, 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 because, you know, there's obviously no results for Psy. And then Rupert's turned around and just said, well, can I just ask you, have you read my research? And he said, no, but I'd be very suspicious of it if I did.
Right.
And that's just ridiculous.
Right.
That just
right.
makes me laugh out loud. That it's crazy.
I wouldn't believe it even if it was true.
Yeah, and hasn't read anything, and yet says that it's not, shouldn't be at a science conference. You know, what other field would a scientist be able to say, you know, that medical stuff shouldn't be at this conference because it's absolute crap, but I haven't read the research? You know, they'd be laughed out of town, but they get to say it when it comes to paranormal, parapsychology, all that sort of stuff. You know, it's crazy, really. And again, how do you change that perception? It's that perception that psi can be ridiculed to start with that lets people get away with that sort of nonsense.
What do you think that's all about? How do we get to a point where the questions that are really the most basic, fundamental questions that we all have, that if you went and asked somebody, you know, they would be it. If you asked it to them in church, or if you asked it to them on the street or wherever, it's, you know, who am I really? Where did I come from? Where am I going? How did these questions become, I don't know, giggle questions?
Yeah, there's a great quote from Michael Grosser, one of my favorite researchers on the afterlife, where he says, you know, the current budget in America for the technology of death, the military budget, is in the billions, you know, $100 billion, whatever. You know, compare that to the budget for researching whether there's an afterlife. You know, did I hear an amused snicker, Michael says. So, you know, I think there's probably two things. There's one, this, you know, as I said, the fringe, it's populated by a lot of strange people, and so, you know, people start associating those people who are making really wacky claims with the subject in general. So, you know, maybe we need to reclaim, you know, that area ourselves. There needs to be a bit of self-regulation, just, you know, pushing people aside when they're making crazy claims. The other thing is that maybe just people like to live in that ignorance. You know, they like to live in that material world of not thinking about, thinking deeper, because sometimes it might be scary to think about your own mortality, to think about whether you're going to live on after you die. It's, you know, there's a lot of people that I know that would call themselves Christian who don't think at all about, you know, the actual teachings. They don't think about what it all means or anything like that. very early in life, they were just happy to call themselves Christian, and there's this, I think there's just this thing in the back of their mind that, you know, I'll probably live on in heaven after I die, and that's as far as they want to go with it. So there's probably a bit of fear there, I think, in confronting some of these issues might be, you know, at the heart of the issue.
Well, I think you're right, and it's funny you should mention that, because I just completed an interview with Denise O'Leary, who's one of the co-authors of The Spiritual Brain, and she's a Christian Science writer in Canada. And, you know, we had this kind of frustrating debate when I was saying basically exactly what you're saying. You know, why not just follow the data, you know, wherever it goes? And you believe, like I do, that the materialistic paradigm falls apart. But, you know, what are you willing to go wherever that data might take you? And I just heard echoes in this conversation of talking to a skeptic, talking to a hardcore dogmatic skeptic who just is very, very, it doesn't even realize the extent to which they've grown accustomed and have this wall of comfort around their paradigm, and will do anything to prevent any breaches in that wall that they've built.
Yeah, and that's probably one of the things I really like about, you know, sitting on the edge of science. Some of the people you meet that are, like as you said, they're willing to just follow the data, could mean something very strange, could mean something very boring, you know, they're just willing to follow the data, whereas, you know, both religious fundamentalists right through to the skeptical fundamentalists, there's just this closed-mindedness that you just cannot discuss anything with them. You cannot point out interesting data and say, let's see where this goes. You know, they're just closed-minded to it. And so I think that's why I like hanging around the edge here, because you do meet some interesting people who are willing to just follow the data.
Well, where do you see things going for yourself and for the Daily Grail in the future?
I'm right in the middle of trying to redesign the site at the moment. Again, every couple of years I try and just update it to the latest, you know, technologies and things like that. So trying to make it even more interactive than it is. You know, currently we have blogs for members. They can post their own thoughts and things like that. So just trying to set up some groups now so that, you know, we can look at certain topics and you can join a group, and just on one page, everyone that's in that group can discuss that one certain topic. So just, you know, just some new technologies in the new page that we're designing. Beyond that, I'd like to eventually try and build up an income source so that I can devote, you know, full-time work on it. And, you know, then you can go into the video side of things. You know, it can become a whole... The Daily Grail could become just the center point, I think, for a lot of fringe stuff if we can get it to that stage. I don't think it's at that stage at the moment, but I'm slowly trying to build it. But, yeah, interesting times ahead for it, that's for sure.
Well, great, great. I certainly enjoy checking it out whenever I get a chance, and I've just pulled it up right here, and I see a very interesting video with Michael Shermer and his...
the spoon bending one. I try and put the skeptical stuff on there as well sometimes.
That's great. That's great. Well, Greg, thanks a lot for joining us today on Skeptico, and I'm going to have a couple of links up to both the Daily Grail and maybe to that article on Randy. Any last thoughts before we wrap it up?
No, I think it was a fun discussion. I think, you know, at the core there is that we just need to keep on plugging along and just keep educating the public, and just keep following the data wherever it leads, as you said. But, you know, that's the most important thing, is just, and that's science, following the data wherever it leads. So people can call you anti-science, or as Randy has called me, a grubby. But, you know, if you follow the data, then you're doing science, and we should not worry too much about what other people call us.
Thanks again to Greg for joining us today on Skeptico. If you'd like more information, a link to the Daily Grail, a link to that article he did on the amazing Randy, check out the Skeptico website. That's at SKEPTIKO. You'll find links to all our previous shows as well, an email link to me, and a link to our forums. Well, that's going to do it for today. Much, much more coming up, many things happening around here, and hope to have some more news to report real soon. So until next time, bye for now.